You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Sanity in the midst of a world that's absolutely insane. So, welcome to the program. Congratulations on making a fine intellectual decision to join this program today. So, well done. Probably top domestic story this morning is civil rights leader and icon of that movement, John Lewis. His body will lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. So an honor not afforded to many, and certainly richly deserved by him. And I first encountered John Lewis in a trilogy I read about the civil rights movement. It's a Pulitzer Prize winning trilogy. Written by Taylor Branch. And I should get Taylor Branch on this show. Just occurred to me. 73 years old, lives in Atlanta. There's a Wikipedia page devoted to Taylor Branch. Anyway. Born in January of 1947, an American author and historian best known for his trilogy of books chronicling the life of Martin Luther King, and much of the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. The third and final volume of the 2,912-page trilogy, collectively called America in the King Years, was released in January of 2006, and a selected summary of the trilogy, The King Years, Historic Moments of the Civil Rights Movement, was released in 2013. I had seen John Lewis on TV and whatnot as an American politician. But I came to know him a little bit and through Taylor Branch in his works. So Taylor Branch went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill on a Moorhead Scholarship, whatever that is. Graduated in 1968, so he's in college during the years of the Civil Rights Movement, high school and college. He went to the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, which has since been renamed. and earned a master's in public administration. He was a lecturer in politics and history at Goucher College. Goucher College, a private liberal arts college in Towson, Maryland, chartered in 1885. Formerly a women's college before becoming coeducational. Anyway, I begin to read. There's three volumes of it, right? There's three volumes. One, the first one is called Parting the Waters, the King Years, 1954 to 63. The second volume is called Pillar of Fire, America During the King Years, 1963 to 1965. And the third is called At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. So that's where I discover John Lewis. And one of the things that Taylor Branch does in that trilogy, like I said, it's almost 3,000 pages long, right? So, I mean, and the thing that, you know, for when it comes up, when I'm talking with friends or whatnot, that I relate to them, it's like, when you read that, it reads like fiction, right? This was only 50 years ago in our country, right? And the stuff that goes on, you read it and it's jaw-dropping. Absolutely, positively jaw-dropping. And, you know, the way blacks were kept from the ballot box, the way if they tried to go down, you know, you tried to do the right thing and go down and register to vote. You know, story of a Mississippi. And again, I'm not picking on Mississippi. It's just where it happened. It's the truth. A painful thing here on All Marine Radio, but, deputy get called to the registrar of voters office. We have a black man trying to register to vote. So obviously a troublemaker, right? Deputy shows up, guy's leaving, wasn't allowed to register. Deputy confrontation with him, takes out a pistol and shoots him. Shoots him in the neck. Throws down a tire iron. Says that he was assaulted. After the man recovers, he's tried for assault on a deputy. And he's sentenced and he goes to jail. I mean, you're reading that and you're thinking, wow. And that's how it worked. So anyway, so the book is just full of that stuff. And that had to do with, those are stories that come out of, you know, you had young people from around the country go down and work on this voter drive in Mississippi. And these are the stories they tell as they encounter a part of the world, happens to be in our country, that they can't believe exists, right? They're followed when they go places, right? They're shot at, okay? Their vehicles are wrecked. They're threatened, right? So in any way, shape, or form, you could be intimidated. And most of them, you know, the vast majority of them went home and never came back. And that's the way of intimidation. And so anyway, especially in the Jim Crow South, and that's what they were dealing with, and small town, not big, you know, not in Atlanta, right? But in small towns and molehills, as Dr. King refers to them, around the country. And so Taylor Branch documents that. And so I'm reading that, and you encounter John Lewis. Now, Lewis's involvement in the civil rights movement, right, starts in Nashville. Okay. As a kid, he aspired to be a preacher, right? Grew up on a farm. He talks about by the time he was six, he'd only seen two white people in his entire life. as he gets older, they go, he takes trips with his family, right? And that's where he encounters racism. And through relatives that lived in the North, he had heard that in the North they had integrated schools, they had integrated buses and businesses. In 1955, he hears Martin Luther King on the radio. And in later years, he follows the Montgomery bus boycott, and he aspired to be a preacher. At the age of 15, he does his first public sermon. He meets Rosa Parks when he's 17. He meets Dr. King for the first time when he's 18. So you can see this is, you know, he's not your average kid. He's not your average kid. He graduates from American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, Tennessee, was ordained a Baptist minister. He received a bachelor's degree in religion and philosophy from Fisk University. As a student, he dedicated to the civil rights movement. He dedicated himself to the civil rights movement. He organized sit-ins, and that's the first time I, you know, you hear about him in Taylor Branch's book. This guy named John Lewis, who was in Nashville, organizing sit-ins. And he was responsible for the desegregation of the lunch counters in Nashville. He was arrested and jailed numerous times as they attempted to desegregate the downtown area, right? And it's those famous pictures of young people mostly sitting at lunch counters. And then they would get arrested and hauled away, and somebody else would sit down. And they disrupted the business to such an extent that those lunch counters were desegregated. He was also instrumental in organizing bus boycotts, another nonviolent protest in the fight for voter and racial equality. So you see his name as he attends, as he rises in the civil rights movement in prominence as you know, the thing in Nashville, you know, is successful and other people copy it. And what you see is where somebody had success, they would obviously be brought to a different part of the country to tell other, I mean, there was no internet, right? And so you could have a phone call or you could try to get somebody there, raise the money, try to get somebody there to speak to a group, to inspire them, but also to plan tactically what you would do. So John Lewis traveled a little bit and participated in, you know, nonviolence workshops. And he practiced, you know, essentially practiced that for the rest of his life. He was one of the original freedom riders. 13 people, 7 whites and 6 blacks, who were determined to ride from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans in an integrated fashion. And let me just tell you, when you read that story, holy shit, right? Holy shit. I mean, literally, you think you're in some kind of like Quentin Tarantino, The World's Upside Down, you know, combined with Mad Max craziness. It's amazing. And Taylor Branch, I mean, you can imagine, in 3,000 pages, you know, he devotes a little bit of time to that. And they cross a state line in Alabama, and the in the bus, they try to run the bus off the road. Eventually, one bus, I don't know if it breaks down or stops, and the bus gets set on fire. And there's white guys from the Ku Klux Klan, as it turns out, and they're outside the bus with guns, and they won't let anybody off, and the bus is burning. Yeah. The bus is burning. The other bus had pulled over. There was two buses. And I'm not sure if this was the first attempt or the second attempt. But anyway, you read about it and you're just like, holy shit. And then they get back on the buses at some point and they go to Birmingham. And when they go to Birmingham, that it's that scene that's well documented. In fact, the Ku Klux Klan, the leader of, and I don't recall the names, but he calls Bull Connor in Birmingham, and who's the chief of police, who will become famous later on for a lot of other things. And he says, look, you need to stay out of that bus station for about 10 minutes. And Bull Connor says, okay. And so the bus pulls in, and there's Freedom Riders get yanked off that bus, and they get the shit beat out of them in that bus station in Birmingham. And there's very famous pictures of it, right? There's a guy who's an ABC News correspondent. His name's John Sigenthaler. You may recognize the name. And he's been, you know, he's been a big-time journalist for a long time. His father happens to be like a press guy or some kind of aide to President Kennedy. And he got sent down there to, you know, he happened to be at the bus station. I think he was in the area, and I'm not sure he was there to watch specifically that, but he had heard that they were going to arrive, and he went down there. Well, he shows up in his East Coast preppy suit, and when these guys that are beating the shit out of everybody, they see him watching, they look like he's not from around here, right? They beat him, and he winds up in a coma. Yeah, one of President Kennedy's aides. And so, yeah, John Lewis, a part of all of that. And so his body arrived in Washington, D.C. Talk about someone who lived an incredible life. That is John Lewis. We should all be so fortunate as to live a life as full as John Lewis. And just an incredible American, and certainly worthy of the nation to pause for his lifetime devoted to his country. I'm reading about his freedom ride. So they get to South Carolina. So they're not even into Georgia and Alabama yet. Lewis and other freedom riders were beaten by angry mobs, arrested at times, and taken to jail. At the age of 21, Lewis was the first of the freedom riders to be assaulted while in Rock Hill, South Carolina. He tried to enter a white-only waiting room at the bus station, right? Two white men attacked him, injured his face, kicking him in the ribs. Nevertheless, only 2 weeks later, Lewis joined a freedom ride that was bound for Jackson, Mississippi. Quote, we were determined not to let any act of violence keep us from our goal. We knew our lives could be threatened, but we had made up our minds not to turn back. Lewis said towards the end of his life in regard to his perseverance following those acts of violence. Lewis also was imprisoned for 40 days in the Mississippi State Penitentiary in Sunflower County, Mississippi, for participating in Freedom Rider activity in that state. So you can imagine. I mean, and he's just a young guy. In an interview with CNN during the 40th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, John Lewis recounted the amount of violence he and 12 other original Freedom Riders endured. In Birmingham, the riders were beaten with baseball bats, chains, lead pipes, and stones. They were arrested by police who led them across the border into Tennessee and let them go. They reorganized and rode to Montgomery, where they were met with more violence, and Lewis was hit in the head with a wooden crate. Quote, it was very violent. I thought I was going to die. I was left lying on the Greyhound bus station floor in Montgomery, unconscious, said Lewis, remembering the incident. When CORE, which was the organization, and I can't remember what CORE stands for, gave up the Freedom Rides because of the violence, Lewis and fellow activist Diane Nash, who's another hugely prominent person in the civil rights movement, arranged for the Nashville students to take it over and bring it to its successful conclusion. So that's what's so interesting about what Taylor Branch does, right? So he links all these different organizations together in this extremely broad, you know, view of the civil rights movement. And so it's really interesting because you see Dr. King in the middle of this hurricane, and, you know, there's people that like him, there's people that don't like him. And you see guys like John Lewis, who rises to prominence, but he's never at the level, at least, you know, in those years when he was younger, Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, and the people that led the Southern, I think the Southern Leadership Council, the SLC. And so those people were extremely prominent, and Lewis was one of the young guys who, again, you know, cut his teeth in Nashville. And so his history, I mean, his life history is an amazing story, is an amazing story. And so, again, he, his casket has arrived at Andrews Air Force Base and will make its way to the Capitol. So, again, I would tell you, if you're looking for a great read, pick up and start, or listen to, you know, I should probably do that. Maybe that will help me finish it. I should listen to that instead of trying to read it, because my days are filled with other things. And sometimes when I lay down to read or sit down to read, you can set your stopwatch before I'm asleep. So maybe I should listen to it during the day. Let me tell you what we're going to do today. I want to talk about John Lewis. I also want to talk about an experience I had over the weekend. I started to do something for somebody. Somebody who I know has, I didn't really know them. They had seen post-traumatic warning. And, she doesn't care if I use her name, but her name is, Stacy Falzerano. And when I spoke at the Space Force, Stacy was there in, right at the end of February, February 29th, if I'm not mistaken. And so, Stacy's husband, Tom, a colonel in the Air Force, Brigadier General Select, Air Force Academy graduate, he died very suddenly of a massive heart attack in May. And she reached out to me in June and said, I've talked to a lot of people, but I can't get the words that you spoke when you came to Peterson Air Force Base here in Colorado Springs and spoke about post-traumatic winning. Do you think that we could talk? And I said, absolutely, we can talk, you know? So anyway, I've got to know Stacy a little bit. So we were kind of texting over the weekend, and, you know, she said, you know, when you get out to the East Coast, you know, make sure you keep me abreast so I can come see it. So I can see post-traumatic winning. And I thought, well, hell, I can just do a version for you, and I can do a version for you, and I can't email it or anything like that, but I can send you the link. You can download it and you can watch it as you choose. And she said, you don't have to do that. I said, no, I'd be happy to. So yesterday I set about doing that. And I have to tell you that I'm enjoying it. Now, I'm about halfway through. Post-traumatic winning is about 2.5 hours long when I present it publicly. And I will tell you, it's an effort to jam it into 2.5 hours. That's how dense it's become. I have a script that is how many pages long? 12. My script is 27. The script for it is 26 pages long. And every one of those pages is portrait. It has a grid system on it, so it's three boxes across, and there's three rows of boxes. So a total of 9 boxes, and every one of those boxes has a slide in it, and underneath the slide it has the bullet points that I make when I talk about that slide. So there's 26 pages of that. Now, what I've learned to do is, depending on the audience, I tailor it, right? I trim this, I add this, blah, 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 blah. And so, when I was doing it yesterday, I don't have to be constrained relative to time. So I can make it as detailed and nuanced as I care to. And so I found it an enjoyable experience. And so I will go ahead and do that. And what had occurred to me is that I could do that for other people as well. People that are not in a position to see the full presentation. And I can go ahead and I can create a version for them, and they could watch it. So I'm excited about that. Yeah, I'm excited about that. And so it was a pretty cool and somewhat surprising experience, because when I started doing it, I thought, okay, well, I'll knock this out. And then as I started to do it, I started to think, wow, it'll be different. One of the things I was talking to the VA about when I was talking to them about post-traumatic winning was, I could probably create between 5 and 10 hours of online instruction that goes with post-traumatic winning. So if I'm not constrained by trying to, keep this under 2 hours, and then, and when I say 2 hours to 3 hours, it's somebody introduces it, somebody closes it, so that's maybe 10 minutes on the front, 10 minutes on the back. There's two breaks. That's 40 minutes. And then for the 2 hours that I present, literally I'm sprinting through that. And as I've learned more and more and more, as I've studied this, as people have taught me more, which is probably the better way of saying it, I put that into the presentation. I mean, there's so much that's in there now that wasn't there when it started. In fact, I was talking to somebody and they said, yeah, it's not even the same presentation that you started with. I said, yeah, it's not. But now the cool part is that, Matt Kiker is in there, right? Jack Riley is in there. So when I say things like, I talk about how important the truth is, not only, here on All Marine Radio, but the truth. And I use Admiral Stockdale's Stockdale paradox, when he's talking about confronting the truth, when you're in the midst of great calamity, when you're in the midst of great crisis, you have to do two things. One, never doubt that you will prevail, and two, be willing to confront the truth as it actually is. And so I tell people, if you're willing to confront the truth, in the process of confronting the truth, you'll see the fourth path, Interstate 4, as I call it, and that is the path of post-traumatic winning. And so, and I talk about the truth, and I said, look, the majority of this is the plain-spoken truth of the enlisted Marine Corps. It is the people that I've had on this program for 4 years that come on and talk about, their life, not only during conflicts, during crisis, but what happened when they went home. And it's that plain-spoken honesty and truth that is post-traumatic winning. And so when I do that, I play Jack Riley. And I play a quote from him. And to me, Jack Riley is emblematic of what post-traumatic winning is certainly all about. And I've enjoyed interviewing him and getting to know him as much as I've enjoyed interviewing and getting to know anybody who I've ever interviewed. And so, it goes, right? And so over the weekend, I was listening to a Jack Riley interview, and I thought, you know what? We're going to have Jack Riley week, and this is it. We're going to have Jack Riley week. So we're going to start off with the first interview I did with him and the way I meet Jack, and you're going to hear that today. Then we're going to go through the second interview I did with him. And so you're going to meet him, and you're going to hear a guy who was doing post-traumatic winning a long time ago. And he's certainly an inspiration to me. I mean, guys like he and guys like Bob Nielsen, you know, when I talk to them and I tell them the things that I think and things I've learned, they're like, yes, 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 yes. And it's pretty motivational and inspirational for me as I kind of groped into this path that has become Interstate 4 and the path of post-traumatic winning. So that's in the second hour, you're going to hear Jack Riley today. And if you've never heard him, or even if you've heard him, I tell you this, do not click this off, because you will hear things differently. And this happens to me all the time. You will hear things differently. And it's like, what did he just say? How did I miss that before? I don't remember that. And the reason is you weren't prepared to hear what he was saying. So you heard it, but it didn't resonate. And so, I mean, he's a wonderful, wonderful guy. And he is a, I think he's in the spirit of John Lewis. I mean, he's somebody who served this country for the majority of his life. And since he's come home from Vietnam, the only thing he's done is he's continued to be the squad leader for his Marines. And to this date, as they struggle with the complications of Agent Orange, Jack still does that. He's been, you know, a wealth of knowledge and inspiration to me, and was doing what, you know, was, as I say, was doing post-traumatic winning long before it was ever a thing. So you're going to hear that in the second hour today. So, so kind of a cool weekend. We also celebrated Catherine's birthday last night, so that was always fun. Colleen and I did arts and crafts, so that was always fun. And I got everybody to send a picture, their favorite picture of, or one of their favorite pictures of them with Catherine. And then we took all of them and we put them together, and we put a frame on it, and we wrote some stuff in it, blah, 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 blah. So, and I like gifts like that more. I prefer that to buying somebody something. And then, you know, I'll give her some money. She can go buy what she wants for herself. But to me, gifts that require a little bit of effort, right, a little bit of arts and crafts and a little bit of thought, and not too much thought, but the picture's really beautiful, right? My hammerhead sons, they send pictures, and they're cool pictures of them and their oldest little sister, and then Colleen, a special human being in the family, right, as the baby. Catherine's got a special role in Colleen's life as her older sister. And when I say older, she's 10 years older, so it's not, you know, a 2 or 3 year age difference. So celebrated that last night and had a great time. Myself, my ex-wife, Susan, Colleen and Catherine and I, as well as Jack and Joe. So, yeah, everybody here on the West Coast. So on that note, good morning to you on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, Jack Riley week this week. And so the United States Marine Corps Band makes it official. Good morning. And this is dedicated to Jack Riley. And it's going to be his voice here. He's just a great guy and an incredible inspiration to what I do. And before I play it, let me just tell you about my day Saturday. All right, this is the kind of life I live now. I get up and I didn't have any real plan other than I toyed with doing some yard work, but I was going to watch the Yankee game because baseball games are on and I'm enjoying that. Because it means I don't have to look at the news, which I enjoy. So anyway, I get an email. The email is from the shoeshine guy in from the Denver airport. Yeah, I kid you not. And his name is Alex. And he writes me this note. Hello, Michael. This is Alex from the shoeshine at the Denver airport. I found the card you gave me and reminded me of your story and all that you do for your fellow man. Keep it up. I'm on your side, and the whole universe is on your side. We love you. So I get that at 7:04 in the morning, right? And I look, I'm like, Alex Romero, I don't know him. Open the email, and I read that. So that's how my day, that's how Saturday starts, right? So that's from Alex. The next thing I do is I get an email from a guy who's now the commander, the platoon commander for the platoon that I commanded as a second lieutenant. And I went down and spoke to those guys before they deployed. In fact, they just got back, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. Anyway, I got this. His name's Peter. Sir, I'm the current platoon commander for your old platoon and recently came across your podcast episode where you described meeting my guys during the post-traumatic winning seminar. I look back at the day you visited and I was on duty that day, go figure, so I wasn't there for your seminar. My guys mentioned to me after the fact that you were excited to see the Goon Platoon motto on our shirts. I thought it was remarkable that this tradition has lasted so long, and I made a note to look you up and get some stories of 3rd Platoon back in the day to bring back to the boys. I wrote this down months ago as something to do when I got around to it. After getting back from deployment and still being busy as usual, I came across your podcast episode and was surprised I hadn't found it before. That prompted me to finally reach out. I'm on the tail end of my platoon commander time as I've been Cherokee 3 Alpha for 21 months, which is a pretty long time. I think it would be great to have some traditions and stories from back in the day to pass along to the next lieutenant when I eventually get replaced. I know the boys would get a kick out of it as well. I threw in a picture of 3rd Platoon from a exercise we did on Guam a few months ago. Thanks for your time. So, I mean, another like cool experience that really is created by post-traumatic winning. And then, you know, I started exchanging text messages with Stacy Falzerano. And we'll see, you know, so I'll do this thing. But, you know, Tracy is a writer. So I said, well, if you write, would you care to help me write? And she said, maybe. So anyway, talk about a nothing weekend that turns to something really cool. And all laid at the feet of, in my opinion, post-traumatic winning. So, as I say often, cool on top of cool on top of cool on top of cool. Here's another one. Good morning, Mr. McNamara. My name is Gunnery Sergeant Duvall. I'm an instructor at McTaug in 29 Palms. I would like to thank you for the work you continue to do for the organization and to say your battlefield studies are rock solid. The instructor group here really enjoys them. We enjoy them so much we would like to turn one of them into a decision-forcing case study. Attached is an explanation of the DFC in order to make this impactful for the students. We are trying to insert audio clips from your recorded interview with Colonel Bronzy on urban combat in Ramadi in 2004 into our presentation. And so he asked me if I could send that to him. I did. So again, another, Almarine Radio, doing good things everywhere. And then there's one more that I got. And I think it was a different email account. Some guy named Dan. Just wanted to let you know that after a lot of work and long delay due to the coronavirus, the Scottsdale Marines finally received its charter as a detachment of the Marine Corps League. Due to COVID-19, we had to change our plan of operations. We are using Zoom to conduct meetings. Our goal was to make every meeting interesting and informative through using social activities and guest speakers instead of the boring status meetings and heavy focus on fundraising. Initially, we planned on meeting at an indoor gun range so we could go shooting together, and we still will do that in the future. Since we are locked into Zoom for now, our guest speakers are our main activity. Last week, we had the Sergeant Major of the Phoenix Recruiting Station tell us about his tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and his work with SEAL Team 10 in shipboarding operations. Very impressive Marine. I was wondering if you might be available for a 30-minute presentation in the future, or if you know anyone in your vast array of contacts that might be willing to present to a small group of Marine vets. So I text back, yeah, I'd be more than happy to. Tell me when. I'm in. So again, the wonderful life of Michael McNamara, as it happens to be. So with that said, all of that dedicated to this endeavor of Almarine Radio, and a lot of it to post-traumatic winning. And one of the people that has been a huge influence on me is this guy, Jack Riley. So this dedicated to Jack, and you'll hear from him in about 20 minutes.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
Once you're out of the Corps, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country, we care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. and we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
It's what it's about. This is the United States, right? It is about winning. In spite of what others would have you believe. Yeah, that's right. Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. That comes from Vince Lombardi, by the way. Yeah, it does. All right. Let's see. Currently in Quantico, clouds and a mix of clouds and sun and 90. Yikes. Good luck to you today. Number two sun. You might want to wear cotton. Down the coast at Camp Lejeune, sunny and 90. You know, this is kind of weird because these temperatures tend to be really close and they're not anywhere close to each other. 29 Palms, sunny and 90. For whatever reason, those temperatures track. I'm not sure, I just read them, okay? Camp Pendleton, clouds and 67. Camp Smith in Hawaii is dawn, cloudy and 76. Camp Butler on Okinawa, dark, cloudy at 82. Helmand Province, evening, clear and 98. And in Iraq, it is, in the western part, it is sunny early in the evening and 114. At the home of All Marine Radio, it is partly sunny and 67. Looking for a high today of 75, 75 tomorrow, 75 on Wednesday, Thursday 82, Friday all the way up to 84. Pretty mild summer, I'm not going to lie to you. So we will take a break here on, and then we'll check some news headlines. But you know what? I don't really give a shit about the news today, to be honest with you. I have larger things in my head. Well, first of all, you know, I do. John Lewis is part of current events today. But I'm in like the post-traumatic winning like thing. And when I go there, like a lot of other things go by the wayside. But we'll take a look at the headlines briefly, and then I want you to listen to, I think the first thing we ever did with Jack, where you'll get to know him, if I can find it, because I don't know that I labeled it right, and now I'm sitting here at my computer looking for the first interview we did, because the way I meet Jack is, I meet Butch Neal. And I don't know how I got on to the story of the Battle of Gettlin's Corner. In fact, I probably should go back and think of it. And it might come out of an interview that I did with General Neal about his book, What Now, Lieutenant? So I have General Neal on, and he's a great interview, you know, ton of personality, funny guy. But, you know, his story is amazing if you've never listened to that interview. But General Neal talks about growing up in Massachusetts, and his father passes away when he's young. He goes to work. He puts himself through college, and he works as a garbage man. Yeah, and supports his mother, supports his sisters, and he's just it's just an incredible story of the way he gets through life. And so, so General Neal talks about in that about Gettlin's Corner. And so I think I asked him if we could do a follow-up interview. And so Jack heard both interviews. Yeah. And he sent me an email. You know, and he introduced himself and he talked about how much he enjoyed it, that he was, in fact, a squad leader in India 39. And that's how I meet Jack. So we'll probably start with the first interviews that I did with Jack, and they were on October 2nd of 2018. So I'm looking for that now. So don't touch that dial. More of this fine programming coming up right after we take a break. We'll check news headlines, and then Jack Riley week. Yeah, you know how like National Geographic or whatever has Shark Week? We have Jack Riley week, right? Which is better than Shark Week. All right, don't touch that dial. More Bomberman Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255. And press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Time for us to check the news. Big news is what the National Security Advisor to the President has COVID-19. What's his name, Mr. Richardson? Interesting timing of this story, right? Headline, top story in Stars and Stripes. Quote, harassed by German tax offices, more U.S. military families face financial threats. German towns that house U.S. troops have expanded efforts to impose income tax penalties on some military personnel, say affected families, and an attorney warning that an assignment to Germany carries growing financial risk. So the story, here's another headline. This is discrimination. Germany seeks income taxes from a U.S. airman because he's married to a local woman. Another headline. German lawmakers investigate whether double taxation of U.S. troops, civilians, violates status of forces agreement, which are big deals. Hawaii, another headline, Stars and Stripes. Hawaii bases issue an all clear after Hurricane Douglas passes north of Oahu. Here's a story you don't see so much, right? North Korea says defector likely swam back to, or South Korea says defector likely swam back to North Korea. A defector was suspected of evading South Korean border guards by going through a drainage ditch and swimming back to North Korea in a crossing that escalated tensions on the peninsula and led Pyongyang to lock down a city on virus fears. The 24-year-old man is thought to have evaded detection by passing through a barbed wire blocked ditch and entering a Han River estuary to the sea to the west, then swimming back to North Korea. Kim Jun-rak, a Joint Chiefs of Staff spokesperson, told the media at a Monday briefing. The man was under police investigation over allegations of rape, according to the Nambu Provincial Police. The defector, who had fled to South Korea in 2017, was booked without physical detention last month for sexually assaulting a woman at his home, police added. The man, who hasn't formally been named, doesn't appear to have been infected with COVID-19, South Korean health officials said in a separate briefing on Monday. Wow, you got to be up against it, right? I think I'm going to have to go back. Do I really want to do that? So anyway, so those are headlines and Stars and Stripes. From the Wall Street Journal, the place where you should get your news, Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine begins final stage testing. This pivotal trial will evaluate in 30,000 subjects across the U.S. whether two doses prevent symptomatic COVID-19. So it's a big deal because it's thought to be the most advanced, at least from my reading. It's thought to be the most advanced vaccine that's in production right now. Other big headlines in the Wall Street Journal, Google to keep employees home until the summer of 2021 amid the pandemic. Story I talked about here, just alluded to briefly, but National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien tests positive for COVID-19. Under Armour, which is a pretty prominent apparel company in the athletic world, in the outdoors world, received a notice from the SEC about accounting irregularities. Now, what's interesting about that is Germany is going through, I think the company's called Wirecard, and they were supposedly this very avant-garde German effort to get into the big tech business. And Angela Merkel went to bat for Wirecard. And if you're paying attention to the news recently, they disclosed that they can't find $2 billion of revenue. That's right, with a B. $2 billion worth of revenue. And people have been arrested. Other people have disappeared. And, you know, all the things that go along with stories like that. Like, what? Yeah. That's billion with a B. So there you have it. So anytime you see accounting irregularity, I think it certainly people are sensitized to it. Yeah, $2 billion in this company that was Germany's answer. You know, Germany, you know, not so prominent in big tech, blah, blah, blah. Well, Wirecard's going to show them. Turns out, maybe not so much. In terms of commentary, pretty interesting commentary. Two, I would tell you. One is an opinion piece by a guy named Joshua Katz, K-A-T-Z. Joshua Katz is a professor of classics at Princeton University. And he writes a piece entitled, I Survived Cancellation at Princeton. It was a close call, but I won't be investigating for criticizing a faculty open letter signed by hundreds. And I'll read you the first and last paragraph. Now is the time to debate with renewed vigor existential questions of what counts as justice and how to fashion an equitable society. But the stifling of dissent is impeding the search for answers and driving people who disagree still further apart. Because students like to push boundaries and professors like to argue, colleges and universities are a crucible. Take the university where I teach, Princeton. The campus, or at least the online campus, in the age of the coronavirus, has been in an uproar since early July over a letter of demands to the administration signed by hundreds of my faculty colleagues, and especially over my response to that letter. I was immediately denounced on social media and condemned publicly by my department and the university president. At the same time, the university spokesman announced ominously that the administration would be, quote, looking into the matter further. On July 14th, the journal's editorial board commented, Princeton is demonstrating how a lack of leadership enables the council culture. It is therefore gratifying to report that Princeton's leadership has done the right thing. I learned recently that I am not under investigation. The story of how I survived cancellation should be of interest to others, since I have no doubt that many more people, from once obscured professors to public figures, will be vilified and in some cases materially punished for thought crimes. Anyway, he goes on. and he ends with this. But here we are. The administration is not investigating. Me and my departmental colleagues have taken down their unwise statement of condemnation. Meanwhile, support keeps pouring in from undergraduates, graduate students, and faculty in my department and across the university, from alumni, from teachers all over the country and beyond, and from people unconnected to academia who are concerned that suppressing speech only makes worse the many problems the U.S. faces. All this explains why free speech matters for everyone. The president of Princeton is entitled to express his personal beliefs. So are my colleagues, at least on private websites. And I am particularly impressed with those very few students and alumni who demonstrated courage by writing to me in harsh but thoughtful terms about their objections to my words rather than bullying me quasi-anonymously online. I wish we were not at odds, but how much better it is for people to be permitted to argue than to follow unthinkingly the orthodoxy du jour. Yeah, a little French there. Free speech and robust debate have prevailed at Princeton. So interesting, you know, we've talked about the cancel culture and, you know, again, the cancel culture is quintessentially an American. What is American uniquely American around the world is the Jeffersonian concept, the American concept of the preservation of minority rights. Amazing. The other opinion piece is an editorial board piece entitled Trump's Drug Price Panic. He adopts Biden-like controls that would harm U.S. innovation. So the president late last week signing executive orders. And again, I think much, much dust going up in the air because we're in an election year. So that's the reason for that. Top stories in, I keep looking for news relative to the Bonhomme Richard. If you missed the Lynch Kenny Costantini event last week, it's because I deleted it by mistake. And we regenerated that on Saturday morning. And so it got posted. So if you missed it, you can go back and listen to that. The Eisenhower is now operating in the Mediterranean. So a little update on where are the carriers, Mac? The Lincoln and the USS Macon Island are off the west coast of the United States. Southern California, to be particularly. The USS Tripoli is down in Central America. The counter-drug mission down there. Yeah, the USS Tripoli. The USS Gerald Ford off the East Coast, the Eisenhower in the Med, the Nimitz in the North Arabian Sea, the Ronald Reagan in the Philippine Sea, and the USS America is in Sasebo, Japan. So there's your aircraft carrier. This story from Friday. By Gidget Fuentes, federal investigators with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives are assisting in the criminal investigation into the fire that severely damaged the USS Bonhomme Richard, a Navy official told USNI News. The Naval Criminal Investigative Service, NCIS, with valuable assistance provided by ATF, is conducting a thorough investigation to determine the facts and circumstances surrounding the fire aboard the Bonhomme Richard. NCIS regularly leverages the resources and the expertise of partner law enforcement agencies for investigation. In this case, NCIS requested the assistance of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, because they provide fire investigative resources and expertise. So, anyway, also in this article, the Navy has assigned Rear Admiral Kevin Byrne to lead a safety investigation board, Schwigman said. Its purpose is to identify causal factors. Byrne took command in April of Naval Surface Warfare Center and Naval Undersea Warfare Center. Previously served as a major program manager for surface ship modernization at Naval Sea Command Systems. The safety board is comprised of personnel from NAVC, NAV Safety Center, Naval Surface Forces Pacific, Naval Education Training Command, and Naval Instruction Command, she said. A third investigation, the command investigation, has not begun due to ongoing damage control efforts. Crews continue to work on dewatering and cleanup aboard the Bonhomme Richard in a major overhaul that's being assisted by a $10 million contract with General Dynamics. So, yeah, not a pretty sight is the Bonhomme Richard. But again, how could an American warship in port burn for 4.5 days? I don't rightly understand that. I've never seen it in my life. You have ships that are at sea that experience incredible catastrophe that don't burn that long as damage control gets that under control. So what happened? I think that's a legitimate question because a huge asset. And if you haven't listened to the, Lynch Kenny thing and you didn't hear it live last week, you know, one of the things that the Bonhomme Richard had was it had been retrofitted to take the F-35. Now that makes it not just another big deck amphib. When you have F-35s coming off that thing, I think I make the comment that it is akin to, you know, the contribution of the Jeep carrier of World War II. We cranked those things out. They were not full-blown aircraft carriers. But, you know, when you have a couple squadrons and you had those things all over the place, and if you look at the Battle of Samar, you'll see Jeep carriers, you know, and the contribution they made to the defense of the Philippines and the defeat of the last major elements of the Japanese Navy. Those were Jeep carriers. The Enterprise was away doing other things with Admiral Halsey. Interesting stuff. Top five stories in Early Bird today, and then we'll take a break, and then you'll hear Jack Riley. Number one, after the USS Navy's Bonhomme Richard catastrophe, a far-reaching crackdown on fire safety. That is out of Defense News. The pictures from the Bonhomme Richard, I mean, I'm just looking at some of them. I mean, they're stunning. This thing on fire in San Diego. The U.S. Navy brass is telling sailors and contractors to put fire safety at the center of their work in the shipyards and at the waterfront in the wake of catastrophic fire aboard the amphibious assault ship Bonhomme Richard. You think? Quote, there could be another Bonhomme Richard waiting to happen. If you go back to 2017, who would have predicted we've had two collisions of that magnitude within a month? Gilday said in a July 16th interview with the Defense News. So I'm not waiting for number two to decide we have a trend here. In a situation like this, one incident is enough for me to determine that there could be a trend, and I'm not going to leave it a chance that there might be. Well, you know, that's good, because let me just tell you something. The trend of the United States Navy is a trend of disasters, right? And it is absolutely brutal. And you had the Navy that is not enamored with doing amphibious operations. You had them lose not only a big deck platform that will inhibit amphibious operations somewhere. If the Navy and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs decide that they'll accept that risk in the Pacific, then you'll see a reduced or a somehow modified, you know, presence on the amphibious ready groups that go out with the loss of the Bonhomme Richard. If they decide not to accept that risk in the Pacific, you'll see somebody move, you know, a platform from somewhere else, right, to the West Coast so that that presence can be felt. So anyway, that's a big deal. And it was an F-35 big deck too. And that's a big deal as well. So again, the Navy, I mean, how many more disasters do we need to have before somebody says, hey, we've got a problem? And let me tell you, the Navy, I think, is at the forefront of the civilianization of the United States military. And the Marine Corps is headed down that road. That was the thing General Furness threw up in the air a couple years ago. Hey, we are not disciplined enough. And everybody likes to blow back and say, oh, bullshit. Well, how does a ship stay on fire for 5 days in port? Do you not have the damage control people? Do you not have the skills to fight it? And those ships are designed to contain damage, right? And so for those of us who've lived on ship, there's condition zebra, there's condition yoke, right? X, Y, Z, you know? And so yoke is, I think, the normal way we travel. And that is, and there might be something less severe, but normally hatches tend to be closed, right, when we go to sea. And then there's those little scuttles, the little round thing that you have the wheel on top of it. Those things stay open and you pop down. And there's another condition where those hatches can be up. And so that's how you limit damage, both fire and water. The ship is designed to limit that. How does it stay on fire for 5 days? I don't understand that. So anyway, we shall see what this brings, but I got a bad feeling that, you know, we lost a multi-billion dollar American asset, strategic asset, because the Navy was not prepared to fight a fire. And I'm not happy to say that, but second story, Trump vows base's name for Confederate leaders will not be changing. Why would he die on that hill? I don't get it. I mean, and the middle third of the country that will elect him or unelect him? Do you think they give a shit about that issue? CNN this week cited multiple insider sources that Trump was unhappy with Esper's move, Esper saying that taking action as a Secretary of Defense, effectively banning the display of the Confederate battle flag at all DOD sites. All right. And CNN reports that supposedly the president was upset with Esper. Pentagon officials have declined comment. On Friday, Trump took to social media to announce that he had been discussing the annual defense authorization bill with Senate Armed Service Committee Chairman Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma. Now, why do I see that guy's name, Inhofe and Imhoff? So let's find out. Inhofe. Inhofe, Inhofe. The story goes on, quote, who has informed me that he will not be changing the names of our great military bases and forts, places which we won 2 world wars and more. The president went on, like me, Jim is not a believer in cancel culture. I don't get it. So, and I don't know why he would pick that issue. I mean, to me, it's a straight up loser. Number three, Trump administration officially makes it easier to export military drones. The U.S. State Department has officially loosened restrictions on exporting military grade unmanned aerial vehicles to foreign nations, a move long sought by the defense industry. We have an edge in that, and so I could see why they would be reluctant to do that. But I think our allies can use that help. Number four, the problem is that it not only goes to your allies, but it goes to your enemies as well. So if you release it like that, guess what? You're gonna fight it relatively soon because somebody in one of those countries is going to have it stolen from them, and then it's going to be replicated, blah, 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 blah. Number four, House passes largest VA budget ever, but partisan fights threaten its future. So the House passing it, right, is it might be news someplace, but the Senate, controlled by the other party, we'll see what happens. The $240 billion VA funding measure, which would include about $10 billion more in appropriations for military construction projects, including language blocking President Donald Trump from transferring certain funds to his controversial military wall project and money to begin renaming military bases currently honoring Confederate leaders. Both of those topics have prompted presidential veto threats in the past and are likely to bog down negotiations to move the appropriations bill ahead in the coming weeks. That's why don't get your hopes up, right? Political grandstanding in an election year. Number five, Army investigating how an M1 Abrams accidentally fired on another tank at Fort Bliss, injuring a soldier. What? Officials from the 1st Armored Division are investigating an incident involving an M1A1 Abrams main battle tank accidentally firing on another tank during a training exercise at Fort Bliss. The training incident, during which an M1 Abrams tank qualification exercise, was reported by a defense blog and confirmed to Military Times by Army official. According to defense blog, the exercise included shooting M1002 multipurpose training rounds at moving targets. They said the Abrams tank hit another tank from its own cavalry regiment at a distance of 2,600 meters, more than 1.5 miles away. One soldier was injured, received immediate medical assistance, and is recovering in stable condition, according to Lieutenant Colonel Lindsay Elder, the public affairs officer. 1st Armored Division has started an investigation into the incident. You think? Until the investigation is complete, we have no further comment. What? So, in their optics, did they pick up something that was outside the range? The Abrams tank hit another tank from its own cavalry regiment from a distance of 2,600 meters or more than 1.5 miles away. Yeah, the M1A1, M1A2 is a no bullshit weapon, man. Supposedly they can do that on the move at 3,000 yards. Ask the Iraqis, they'll tell you. Not even close to being within range of the Iraqis, and they're getting smoked. Overseas operations, some headlines. All right. Russia continues to position equipment to support private contractors in Libya, according to the United States AFRICOM. Private contractors, right? What's missing from that? Everybody knows, right? The rim shot, private contractors. Oh, yeah, we get it. U.S. forces Japan require personnel to test negative for coronavirus before leaving quarantine. Got that. They're right in there with Major League Baseball. Air Force tweaks the way it welcomes troops to Tokyo amid the pandemic. All right, so if you're in the Air Force, you might want to check that out. All right, we'll take a break. We go back. Jack Riley. You're going to hear the best of all Marine radio, Jack Riley, coming up next. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. More of this fine program coming up right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.